is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Eight new realities in the Indo-Pacific, this vast amount of water that is peopled by allies, adversaries, and one great big challenge. That would be the People's Republic of China and its projection of power with the People's Liberation Army Navy. We begin with two exercises in the Indo-Pacific region by allies. Gregory, a very good evening to you. What is Talisman Saber, and what is it meant to accomplish? Good day.
Good day to you, John. Well, Exercise Talisman Saber is actually a regular series of exercises normally conducted by the U.S. and Australian troops, and generally involves amphibious warfare exercises. So it's held every 2 years. The current one, Talisman Saber 2021, is now underway off Townsville on the northeast coast of Australia and Queensland. But this time there are about 11 countries involved, including the US and Australia. Japan is down there. India is there. The UK and so on. So you've got New Zealand, obviously, of course, there. So it's basically really gearing up for the first time, I would say, with real purpose, because the US is reorienting its amphibious warfare program. It's looking at a new age of offensive warfare around the world. We're just coming out of literally three quarters of a century of defensive warfare doctrine globally. So now it's moving into much more fluid offensive warfare operations, largely because of what the People's Republic of China is doing. So this is a very significant exercise and at very high level, and getting a lot of attention by U.S. Marine Corps headquarters in the U.S., apart from the various allies of the U.S. around the world.
You report that the PLA and Navy has dispatched an auxiliary general intelligence vessel, AGI. Or is this ordinary, Gregory?
Oh, absolutely. These intelligence gathering ships, are generally about this class of warship is about 6,000 tons. They're fairly sophisticated. This time, they've got two of them, I gather, off the coast of Queensland, outside of territorial waters, but in the exclusive economic zone, perfectly legal. A lot of Australians, however, for the first time, are being indignant about this, quote, invasion of our space by the PLA Navy. But even the Australian Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, has said, look, this is perfectly normal. They're abiding by the law, and we absolutely support freedom of navigation because we expect to conduct freedom of navigation exercises ourselves, implying through the South China Sea and the East China Sea and the like and up the Taiwan Straits. So basically, and the Chinese have been saying, well, look, this is perfectly legal. How dare you impugn us with anything else? The reality is that the Australian public reaction is the new factor in this. The Australian public is now reinforcing its support for the Australian government of Prime Minister Scott Morrison to resist Beijing's attempt to coerce Australia into supporting the People's Republic of China.
The same type of ship, or maybe the same ships, will also be observing an exercise CONCAN. This is the Royal Navy and the Indian Navy. It would appear that the PLA Navy is monitoring the whole of the Quad. Is that the idea here?
Well, there's no question that the PLA Navy is absolutely obsessed with what the Indian Navy is doing and could do. Getting their AGI ships, their intelligence gathering ships, into the Bay of Bengal to monitor Exercise CONCAN is going to be interesting to see whether they can sustain that. They'll certainly be doing a lot of monitoring electronically and from space and the like. So it's going to be interesting to see just how much they can get close to these closed waters of the Bay of Bengal, where the Royal Navy's carrier strike group under HMS Queen Elizabeth, the carrier, and the Indian Navy with its own carriers. It's just going to be interesting to see how close the PLA Navy can get to that. But they certainly are obsessed with what India can do, because the real wild card in constraining and containing the PRC is India.
Yes, India. But I go to another factor that put its card on the table just a few days past. The foreign minister of Japan making a statement that Japan will adamantly come to the defense of Taiwan if attacked. Does that make everybody a little sharper in these monitoring exercises by the PLA Navy, that they realize their traditional enemy is now back in the game?
Absolutely. And it's, of course, the doing of the Communist Party of China, because it's always whipped up the century of shame as a result of Japanese incursions into China in the past. So they've really built up this hatred of Japan, and the Japanese have responded to that. But there's no question that the PRC and the PLA Navy in particular and Air Force are trying to move into the East China Sea, in particular, to dispute Japan's sovereignty over the Senkaku or Diuotai island groups just north of Taiwan. So the reality is that, as the Japanese foreign minister said, and the defense white paper, by the way, of Japan, which just came out, stresses that an attack on Taiwan would threaten Japanese national security. Therefore, they would have to respond. So the implication was fairly clear. Japan would intervene on the side of Taiwan to help defend it if the PRC launched an attack on Taiwan. And because of Japan-U.S. security relationship and treaty, and it's the only security treaty which Japan has, it might automatically involve the United States in coming to the aid of Japan. And the United States, even under the Biden administration, has actually made it clear that it will keep reinforcing Taiwan. It's now committed to providing technology for the new Taiwanese indigenous submarine program, which is quite impressive, and we should see within 2 years new indigenous submarines coming into the Republic of China, the Taiwanese Navy, 2023, with U.S. technology aboard.
Gregory, the change of the weather, is this Moscow talking to Tokyo alarming to Beijing?
Oh, it certainly would be alarming to Beijing, not unsurprising. And in fact, even Foreign Minister Lavrov, I think, who's been very heavy-handed in this, maybe too heavy-handed. I think President Putin is much more delicate in dealing with both Shinzo Abe in the past and with Prime Minister Suga today. But Lavrov is saying, look, Japan need to abandon your security relationship with the United States because that is specifically anti-Russian in its nature. The Japanese don't see it that way. The Japanese actually see the security relationship with the United States now as being very much anti-PRC, not anti-Russia. Uh-huh. But the fact is that Japan and Russia are now finding ways to resume their talks to sign a peace treaty to end World War II. But more than that, they are trying to use that as the stepping stone to build a land bridge from the northern Japanese islands up in to the Sakhalin Island and then across to the mainland. So you'll be able to have a bridge with road and rail traffic possibly to start taking Japanese exports to Europe by land across through Russia, bypassing the Belt and Road Initiative, bypassing the precarious sea lanes down through the South China Sea, Indian Ocean, and Red Sea and the like. So that's very profound.
It strikes me, Gregory, that Japan and Russia are one of those tough marriages. You know, since 1905, they can't stand each other, but they can't get apart either. So we go to another new reality, and you've already touched upon it. India has deployed additional combat troops into the Himalayas to confront the Chinese aggression. Does this worry China that there's loose talk in Delhi? Why don't we just take the whole thing? Let's just keep going and get Tibet back. Does that worry Beijing?
It does worry Beijing, but in reality, India, even with its 900,000 or so troops in Kashmir, doesn't have the wherewithal to make a concerted land invasion of Tibet and the Tibetan Plateau. This has been under contention for hundreds of years, and it was the 1950, of course, the People's Republic of China was able to do a land invasion up into the Tibetan Plateau and conquer a relatively weak Tibet and India at that stage, or and the West could do nothing about it. Indeed, today, all they can do on both the Indian and PRC line is to hold the line. But what India can do is actually make a westward military move across Azad Kashmir, the Pakistani-occupied part of Kashmir, and then to build a land bridge from India and Kashmir over into Afghanistan and up into Turkmenistan. Now, what this would do is would cut the PRC's land bridge from mainland China down through Azad Kashmir and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. So basically, if you want to neuter the PRC, that's the best way to do it. And maybe you then start to constrain the PRC dramatically. It still leaves the control of the headwaters of most of the important rivers in PRC hands on the Tibetan plateau. But that's a fight for another day and another method. But any move by India in this regard to cut across into Central Asia would outflank China to its west and would spell the end of any strategic ambitions of the PRC.
Boxing in the Middle Kingdom, the military exercises, naval exercises in the Indo-Pacific, the Himalayan deployment of the Indian Army, the new realities of the Indo-Pacific. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, CBSi in the World. I'm John Batchelor.